are these two different ones or the same ones? And he says, oh, it's the same one. So he made Chris think.
We are live.
Thank you. Welcome, everyone. I will call the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue to order, and we'll start out by calling the roll.
Senator Findley?
Present by video.
Senator Riley? Senator Wagner?
Present by video.
Vice Chair Boquist?
Present by audio.
Madam Chair Burdick?
Present by video, and please mark Senator Riley as excused and with hopes that he'll be here before too long.
I'm here now, Madam Chair.
Okay, Senator Riley is present by video.
Very good, noted.
Okay, to start out today, we have one bill. It's Senate Bill 139, so I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 139. Kyle.
Right. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Yeah, Senate Bill, once again, Kyle Easton, Legislative Revenue Office. Senate Bill 139 is a bill that's making proposing a few changes to Oregon's pass-through entity reduced rates. Current law, I suppose. So right now, Oregon has a reduced rate policy for certain types of pass-through entities and certain types of pass-through income. And again, we do have the Senate Bill 139. There's also a -1 and a -2 amendment. And again, they're all touching on larger policy discussions. So I do have a couple slides in OLIS titled the SB 139 SMS handout. And I'll go ahead and walk through that as it really sets up the policy discussion of what's being proposed in the introduced version of the measure, and then also in the -1 and the -2 amendment. So I'll see if I can get my screen shared here. Okay, so as I said, Senate Bill 139, we do have the -1 and the -2, and you can really think of it as perhaps there's three policies that are being discussed, I suppose, in the measure as it's introduced, and then as the amendments are there as well. So the first relates to the pass-through entity, the rate change, the reduced rates for this type of income. So again, just a very brief refresher. Oregon's reduced rate policy is for certain types of pass-through entities. So we have, this could include sole proprietors, S-corps, partnerships. They do have an employee requirement with a number of hours for that employee to meet the opportunity for this chance to have this pass-through income taxed at a lower rate. And the second requirement relates to the taxpayer or the owner of the business that's receiving that income. And that taxpayer has to be actively participating in the business. So there's kind of two requirements there. But what the Oregon reduced rate policy is it's providing these reduced rates for this non-passive pass-through income. So the first change or policy change that's being discussed in the Senate Bill 139 relates to adjusting the rates. So right now, these lower rates, there's a lower rate and they're graduated marginal rates. And it ends at $5 million right now in this pass-through income relating where the top 9.9% personal income tax rate becomes effective. So one way of adjusting this reduced rate policy would be adjusting the point at which that 9.9% rate kicks in. And I have a little more information on each of these, 1, 2, and 3, here shortly. The second policy discussion has to do with the types of businesses that can qualify for this income. So there's kind of two proposals you have here. One's in the introduced version, and the other is in the -1 amendment. But the first is excluding certain types of businesses from benefiting from these reduced rates. So the first policy proposal, if you will, would be tying to the business deduction at the federal level and using that Internal Revenue Code language to tie to those businesses that are excluded at the federal level. Oregon could then exclude them from Oregon's reduced rates policy. That's 2A. 2B would be specifying two specific NAICS codes, so two sectors in which businesses reside, and excluding those from Oregon's reduced rate policy. So the two sectors identified here, this often gets referred to as the suits and scrub exclusion, but it's pointing to NAICS sectors 54, which is professional, scientific, and technical services, and then also sector 62, which would be healthcare and social assistance. So again, it'd be removing those business entities from being able to pass through their income at these reduced rates. And the third policy discussion you have is modifying the employee requirement. So again, under current law, the business entity, whether it's the sole proprietorship, the partnership, or the S-corp, they are required to employ one employee that's not an owner of the business, and that employee does have certain hours requirements that they have to meet to be considered for that one employee. So in the Dash 2 amendment, there are some blanks in this amendment. It really is a policy proposal of a way of really linking up perhaps the number of employees to the number of owners. So whether that's requiring maybe a ratio where if you have three owners, you have X number of employees or something to that effect. But again, it'd be a third lever, if you will, in which to adjust the policy. But so the first one, the rate change, what you have in front of you here is these are the existing rates and the income, the pass-through income to which it applies. So you can say the rates, they're marginal rates, and they're set up as low as 7% up to 9.9%. And that's when Oregon's top marginal rate kicks in at income over $5 million. So Senate Bill 139 would have that top marginal rate begin at 9.9% at income over $415,000. So for those taxpayers with pass-through income below that $415,000, they would still receive the same rates, the 7% and the 7.2. So they would be more or less unaffected by this rate change. Income over $415,000, the taxpayer still gets that initial benefit from the reduced rates, but with any income over $415,000 being taxed at the 9.9%. And then what you have here is kind of a distribution of this non-passive income, just to give you a sense of where taxpayers fall in the distribution on this non-passive income. So again, for those, and this is tax year 2017, so it's a couple years old, but for those taxpayers in 2017, it was about 40% of this non-passive pass-through income was received under $415,000. So about 40% is unaffected by this proposed rate change. That above 415, it is set, it would be taxed at 9.9%, but the taxpayers still get that benefit of that first $415,000. So that's an important thing to keep in mind there. But just to give you a sense of where this income falls. Moving to number two.
Senator Finley has his hand up. Senator Finley, do you want to ask your question now or wait?
This is appropriate for this table right now, Madam Chair. Thank you. Kyle, does this rate change by adding all these other groups into that, does this require a three-fifths vote? Is this considered a tax rate increase and require a vote, tax vote?
Yeah, Senator Finley, that's a question. I would reserve that for a legislative council to weigh in on that question. I don't know if they're in the committee hearing right now, but we could definitely reach out to them and have them address that question.
Thank you. I would appreciate a read on that. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Or Chris, maybe you've already looked into this. Feel free to jump in if you have.
The way the bill is currently drafted, LC did not put on the three-fifths requirement. So the question would be, was that in error, or did they look at it and decide that it did not need a three-fifths, and we can follow up with them? But it is not, I'm looking at the bill, and as drafted, it does not include the three-fifths requirement.
But as drafted, it doesn't include the lower threshold for the rate, correct? That's in the amendment, isn't it?
No, the 415 in the table that Kyle put together here, it's, if you look on...
Oh, I see it now.
Page two, yeah, the top part of page two of the bill.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's a good question. Let's double check that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Boquist, did you have a question?
No, I was just going to follow up. We really need to look at the mix at the end, Madam Chair, because remember, I'm the one that went to court on this. And so I'd love to say the answer to Senator Finley's question is yes, but it's not as it is written right now. But it could be depending on what we do.
Okay, thank you. Proceed, Kyle.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. So moving to slide number four, and this is the policy discussion related to the business type. So again, what's listed here is kind of an output of the businesses that are by their sector that are passing through this pass-through income for these reduced rates. So you have the sector code, the sector name, and then you also have the percent of the number of entities. So that's by the number of entities, and then by the percentage share by the income that's being passed through. So again, this is just straight by the number, but by the income pass-through, you can see that change a little bit based upon one entity could, of course, have higher amounts of pass-through income than another. So they could have a greater share in terms of the income, but less in terms of a numerical count. But the green shading that you have in front of you here would relate to those industries potentially affected by using linking to the Internal Revenue Code and that pass-through deduction at the federal level. So by linking to that and excluding those sectors, you wouldn't necessarily exclude every business in that sector. It could grab part of these sectors, but overall it would touch on those shaded in the green. And some of the work we've done in the past, we were estimated at about 20% of the total share would be affected by linking to that federal IRC exclusion. Pointing directly in the Dash 1 amendment, it was using sectors 54 and 62, and those are the ones I bolded here. And with the way it's drafted right now, it would grab that entire sector. But again, there could be adjustments made as you see fit. But again, those are the two, professional, scientific, and technical, and then the healthcare. So combined, they account for about 26% of the income. Okay. So then the last one, number three that I had before was relating to the number of employees. So again, the Dash 2 amendment is really a proposal. It has some blanks in there right now of possibly using a ratio, but again, there could be other ways to adjust the pass-through policy based upon the number of employees, because right now the requirement is one. But this is from information reported to us on the returns from tax year 2018. And it has the share of the non-passive income by the number of employees of the business entity, the sole prop, S-corp, partnership, and then also by the count. So again, this is the numerical, is the share of the blue is based on a numerical count, where the orange bars here show the share of the income. So again, if the way to look at this, I suppose, if you're looking at the number of entities that have 200 plus employees, they account for, let's say, about 12% of all the income, but from a numerical count perspective, it's probably, I mean, that could be 1%, maybe a little less than 1% in terms of a count of those entities. But again, that's because the income they're passing through is that much larger than the others in terms of the share.
Okay, Senator Boquist has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just like Kyle to keep this slide handy, because I'd like to come back to it towards the end of the hearing. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead, Kyle.
Okay, and so Madam Chair, those are the kind of the three policy proposals that are being put forward with the amendments and the introduced version. And that's the information I have for you right now. Again, we do have other that we could provide, but this is what I wanted to put in front of you for today as a high level understanding of where these policies are at.
Okay, thank you. I think, did you want to ask another question on this now, Senator Boquist, or do you want to wait till after we hear from our witnesses?
No, towards the end, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. Okay, our first witness signed up is John Calhoun from Tax Fairness Oregon. John, are you with us?
I am.
Okay, welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. My name is John Calhoun, and I represent Tax Fairness Oregon, a network of volunteers who support a rational and equitable tax code. We have always opposed a preferential tax treatment for business owners. It is a perfect example of our tax code giving to the rich while taking services away from the poor. Oregon workers paid minimum wage to get to the second highest tax bracket of 8.75% on income under $10,000. While the bosses they work for are currently paying only 7% on their first $250,000 in income. For those who claim that business owners take more risk and work harder, I suggest they go into the fields and pick crops, risk their life as a roofer, or work in kitchens scrubbing pots and pans, and tell me they deserve lower tax rates than the workers who do that for a lifetime. I was a small business owner for 25 years without this tax benefit, and somehow managed to survive, create jobs, and add to my wealth. I own businesses that were C-Corps and later partnerships and pass-throughs without these preferences. So did every Oregon business owner until the law was changed in 2013. Let's keep in mind that the struggling businesses that defenders of this tax always use an example to justify tax breaks for the wealthy often pay no taxes because they're losing money. Lowering tax rates will not help the And that's especially true of startups, which I did several. This preferential rate is sometimes defended in comparison to C corporation rates, which are lower than our personal income tax rates. My response is that those who want those rates should organize their businesses as C corporations. Of course, then they would have to pay both the corporate rate and also the personal income tax rate for any dividend payments they made to themselves. The pass-through partnership structure allows owners to avoid paying taxes twice. It does not need a lowered rate in any circumstance. While we would prefer a bill that eliminates these preferential rates, we are pleased to see this committee considering narrowing who gets the benefits. Excluding lawyers, accountants, physicians, and other consulting professionals is a positive step. So is reducing the cap from $5 million of income per partner to $415,000. However, we still do not understand why anyone continues to get these tax breaks on the first $415,000 of income. The median Oregon family income in 2019 was $67,000. The committee must continue this inequitable preference. Why not put the cap nearer the median income? Why should families earning more than the average Oregonian get lower than average tax rates? Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Calhoun? Okay, our next witness is Daniel Hauser. Are you with us, Dan? There you go.
I am. Thank you, Chair Burdick. Vice Chair Boquist and members of the committee, my name is Daniel Hauser, tax policy analyst for the Oregon Center for Public Policy, and I respectfully submit this testimony regarding Senate Bill 139. Pass-through business owners should not pay a lower tax rate on their profits than their employees pay on their wages. We should not have a tax system in place here in Oregon where the lawyer who owns a practice is paying a lower tax rate than a paralegal or a janitor who cleans that building. This is a fundamental tenet of tax equity, and it's something that I believe the Oregon legislature can address by eliminating this policy from Oregon's law entirely, rather than just amending it and making it slightly less worse. Currently, taxpayers reporting an annual pass-through business profit of more than $5 million can see their tax cut reach over $70,000. Under this legislation, these high-income taxpayers would still receive the tax break, though the effective cap would come down to less than $10,000. This would be an improvement, but we would still be putting millions of dollars that could be invested in our schools, wildfire recovery, or any number of other tremendous needs that our state has and Oregonians have today, would all be better uses for these resources than subsidizing many of the richest 5% of Oregonians as the policy does today. As can be seen in a chart that I've uploaded as part of my testimony in OLIS, it's reflected in some of the work that LRO has done. Nearly $7 and $10 from this tax break flow to folks making over $500,000 in a single year. This is very much the top 1% of all income earners in Oregon that are receiving the majority of this tax subsidy. Less than $1 and $10 of the benefits flow to Oregonians making under $200,000. This tax policy should be eliminated. However, scaling it back, as Senate Bill 139 does, is a move in the right direction. Please amend Senate Bill 139 to end this regressive, inequitable, and poorly targeted tax break. There's one point I want to also add, which is that when we think about tax policy, it's often a bit of a struggle to connect it to the impacts of racial equity and the impacts taxes have on the outcomes for families of color in our state. When we think about a reduced tax rate that disproportionately benefits folks who own businesses and have over $500,000 in profits in a year, we can say with some confidence that Oregonians of color are less likely to be high income in the state. Oregonians of color are also less likely to own businesses than white Oregonians. And so looking at a tax break like this through a racial equity analysis, it's pretty easy for us to reach the conclusion that this actually perpetuates racial inequities in our state, leaving this policy in place. And reversing it would help at least raise some resources that could be invested in helping to really redress and improve the outcomes for families of color in our state. And with that, I'll conclude my testimony. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Are there questions for Mr. Hauser? Thank you. Our next witness is Scott Bruhn from the Oregon Business and Industry Group. Scott.
Is the camera where? There we go. Good afternoon, Chair Burdick, Vice Chair Boquist, and Revenue Committee members. My name is Scott Bruhn, and I am the Director of Tax and Fiscal Policy for Oregon Business and Industry. OBI is a member-led business trade association with over 1,600 members that employ more than 330,000 of our fellow Oregonians. I'm testifying today in opposition to Senate Bill 139. Senate Bill 139 would raise taxes on thousands of Oregon partnership businesses at a time when many of those businesses are still reeling from the economic effects of COVID. These businesses are not the euphemistic large corporations. They are small and medium-sized businesses that operate in every corner of our state and in every commercial business activity that you could think of. These could be businesses with 2 employees, 20 employees, or even 200 employees, each with an interest in keeping those employees working and maintaining operations during perhaps the biggest economic challenge of our lifetime. There is no question that some Oregon businesses have done well during the current crisis. Some have done exceptionally well. That's actually great news. It's something we should celebrate, not punish or lament. Those businesses, whether they employ 2 or 200, have kept Oregon moving forward. They've kept their people working and they have played by the rules. They've overcome hurdles and they will pay the full taxes that they owe under current statute. More than they would pay, of course, if they had not done as well. But we shouldn't let success stories sidetrack us. The fact is most businesses have suffered and are behind where they would otherwise be if it were not for COVID. Senate Bill 139 would raise taxes on those businesses during this time of economic stress. These tax increases would make it harder for Oregon businesses to compete, harder for them to hire, harder for them to give raises, and maybe even harder for them to retain the people they currently employ. It's also important to remember, as we've discussed before, that every Oregon business, partnership or not, will already be experiencing a 41% increase in their overall tax burden by 2022 when tax measures approved in 2019 are fully implemented. COVID notwithstanding, Oregon's business tax burden has increased from 40th highest in the nation to 19th highest in the nation in a very short period of time. Respectfully, the businesses which employ Oregonians are having a hard enough time swallowing that big pill. They are certainly not in a position to take on yet another tax increase. Finally, Madam Chair, I want to address a provision of the bill which would carve out entirely the pass-through rate benefits for what the IRS calls a specified service trade or business. These are businesses where the principal asset of the business is the knowledge or reputation of its employees or owners. It seems strange that we would single out these type of businesses. Are some of them doing well? Of course they are. But there are also many small businesses in this sector that have struggled to overcome major obstacles. Think of the dentist office, which was required to close for 4 months last year and where even now patients are slow to return. Think of the boutique graphic design shop, the boutique financial advisory firm, or even the boutique law firm focusing on tenant rights. All of these are working to overcome COVID-related challenges, and none, I would venture to say, are in a position to easily handle another major tax increase. Madam Chair of Committee, for these reasons, OBI respectfully urges you to say no to Senate Bill 139. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Riley, your hand is up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So let me understand, people who aren't making profit won't be paying these, is that correct?
Is that question directed to me, Senator?
It is.
Yes.
So the people that won't make profits are not paying these?
Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay, so the people that you say were struggling and aren't doing well, they won't be paying this.
No, thank you, Madam Chair, Senator, for the question. My point to that is a business could still be profitable, but it could still be struggling. I mean, a net loss is not necessarily a definition of struggling. It's certainly a definition of struggling. But a business that would say, I mean, if the business was, I'm just going to use couple of examples and numbers, but if that business was making, you know, $200,000 a year ago and $20,000 this year, that's a struggling business, even though they're still profitable.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Other questions from the committee? I see no questions. So our next witness is Anthony Smith.
Yes, Chair Burdick, Vice Chair Boquist, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Anthony Smith, Oregon State Director for the National Federation of Business, Independent Business, representing thousands of small businesses across the state, many being the smallest of small businesses, with about 90% of our members having fewer than 25 employees. and 70% having fewer than 10 employees. Madam Chair, I'm very sorry that I'm unable to appear on your screen today. I'm experiencing some technical issues, if you can bear with me. I'm just hoping I don't lose audio, so I'm going to be as brief as possible.
Okay, welcome.
NFIB is opposed to Senate Bill 139 because the main purpose of the bill seems to significantly restrict eligibility for this tax policy while at the same time raising revenue. Unlike other approaches, which could reform the policy to achieve certain revenue neutral policy goals, SB 139 simply raises revenue without a specific policy objective to justify the tax increase. As a little bit of background, the small business pass-through entity tax rates were part of that grand bargain from the 2013 special session. The package of bills that passed during the special session included House Bill 3601, which among other provisions increased the corporate tax rate from 6.6% to 7.6% on incomes between $1 million and $10 million, and then it lowered the rates for taxpayers with certain income with income meeting certain criteria, with the policy objective to provide a more favorable tax rate structure for businesses, business income earned by taxpayers who actively manage their own business. And that's where we are today. Overall, House Bill 3601 was a bill for raising revenue, and it did require a three-fifths supermajority. Additionally, from a tax expenditure perspective in terms of dollars, this policy has performed pretty much exactly as it was intended. In the five tax years that the PTE rate structure has been in place, the revenue impact to the state has come in at or under projections each year. The number of taxpayers utilizing the rate structure has been relatively stable year over year, and the sideboards that were part of the original legislation that passed in the 2013 special session have not been triggered. And I would invite LRO to correct me if I'm wrong, but I haven't seen anything to indicate that those sideboards are projected to trigger in the future. Senate Bill 139 restricts a small business tax policy that was just expanded less than three years ago. It was the one and only bill that passed during the 2018 special legislative session. And it was the whole reason the governor called the special session in the first place. Just briefly, I'd like to draw your attention to some elements of House Bill 2604, which was heard in the House Committee on Revenue earlier this afternoon. That's a bill on a similar topic, and that bill provides for lower rates for businesses with modest levels of income and proposes changes to the employment requirements, potentially expanding the pool of eligible taxpayers and making the process of tracking hours worked by employees more straightforward and less of an administrative burden. And the bill sponsor has also expressed a desire to have this approach be as revenue neutral as possible. So with that, NFIB respectfully asks the committee to oppose House Senate Bill 139. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, Madam Chair. And again, my apologies for my technical difficulties.
Well, thank you. Senator Riley, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you. But this is for Kyle. Could you remind us, Kyle, at what level an individual taxpayer hits the 9% and the 9.9%?
Yeah, Senator Riley, in terms of under the standard rates, the 9.9% would kick in for a single filer at $125,000 or for a joint filer at $250,000. For the reduced rates, that's at the $5 million. Over $5 million is where the 9.9% kicks in for these reduced rates.
Thank you, Kyle.
People who are taking this tax break, they can't deduct other expenses from their taxes. However, they can deduct business expenses, including the cost of paying employees. Is that correct, Kyle?
Yeah, Madam Chair. So in this case, it depends upon an individual taxpayer on whether they can use. One of the things when you use these reduced rates is you can't use your deductions against those non-passive income that's getting the reduced rates. If the taxpayer has other types of income that's unrelated to this pass-through income, those deductions could still be used to offset, say, other wage income or something of that effect, but not against this passive or this non-passive pass-through income. In that case, those deductions can't be applied. So for a taxpayer, they really can decide whether they want to opt into this or not based upon their own particular circumstances and whether it benefits them from an overall tax liability standpoint.
So if you had a very wealthy couple, for example, one of whom had W-2 income and the other one had a business, then the person with the business could deduct, obviously, their business expenses from their profits. And then if they had other deductions, they could deduct those against their spouse's deduction income, correct?
Yes, Madam Chair. And that's, yeah, that would be kind of the best for both worlds for that taxpayer's perspective. And yes, from a business entity standpoint, it is, you'd have your business receipts minus your business expenses in the traditional way that an entity would calculate their net profit, if you will. And that positive income that gets passed through the taxpayer, that's what can then be applied to the reduced rate. So yes, you still get the other business deductions from the business entity level, yes.
Right. So that's part of the reason why this tax system benefits primarily the highest income Oregonians, correct?
Yeah, Madam Chair, there's definitely an association just with taxpayers that have this business income that often will put you into the higher income category. And when we look at it the other way as well, if you're a higher income taxpayer, you're often going to have business income as well.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, we are through our witness list. Senator Boquist, did you want to ask questions about those charts?
Yes, ma'am. If Kyle would put his slides back up, I would like to ask some questions starting on page 3 of Kyle's charts, if you would, ma'am.
Okay, Kyle, can you manage that? Is that the one you want, Senator Boak? Oops, there we go.
Yes, ma'am, Madam Chair. Just starting with that. Kyle, in the right-hand set of statistics that are over there, right, could you do a little bit more detailed explanation of that? My understanding of that chart is that is the percentage of actual filers, percentage of qualifying income and non-passive income coming in based on the filer type. And I see at the very bottom, it's 40% or 415,000, but those next columns going up from 1 million down to 5 million on that chart. Could you clarify the number of actual taxpayers roughly we're talking about? Are we talking about 13%, for example, or $1 to $2 million tax filers?
Yeah, Senator Boquist. So you're right. I think in terms of giving some background on this table, for a taxpayer that, say, is right at that 415,000, they could be at 416,000, let's say. They would be in this $400,000 to $500,000 category. And it's only that amount above the 415,000 that is subject to, I guess, this 9.9% rate when if it was to get reduced. So that's just for clarification. That wasn't specific to your question, but just you were interpreting the table correctly and how this is laid out. I am searching for my notes here from the conversation we had on the House side to see if I can address in real time your question here on the breakdown of the taxpayers. I don't have, unfortunately, Senator Boquist, I don't have that information in front of me right now today. But yes, we absolutely do have that breakdown in terms of the count for these taxpayers, because as you said, this is the percent of total qualifying income, which is going to be a larger share as you move higher on the non-passive income category, of course.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. If we could have Kyle bring that back to the committee as we go forward, that would be good. And then follow-up questions, ma'am?
Please follow up.
If you would go to chart number 4, and while you're going to chart number 4, I would commit that one of the key points that, you know, I think everybody's trying to figure out is help the right people, and figuring out the number and where those right people are is why we need that other information. On chart 4, Kyle, you had made mention, and we talked about this, I think in 2015, it was not in the 2013 discussions that Senator Burdick and I were involved, but in 2015, I think there was some pretty in-depth discussion about this. You mentioned the federal tax code and that the sector code 54 and sector code 62, they are they are regulated and somewhat exempted and capped in the federal tax code. Is that not correct? And if we align with that, if we align this policy with the federal tax code in those particular, I call them NAX codes, but those sector codes, what would transpire?
Yeah, Senator Boquist, so in terms of the federal, linking up to the federal, that's what I was saying is the sectors here overlap with those federal restrictions at the federal level for the pass-through deduction that the federal have. It wouldn't necessarily capture that entire sector. So it could be businesses that are within that sector might still be able to use Oregon's reduced rates, but not certainly not all of them. And that was the intent of trying to highlight that, where it is going to be part of that sector. So if Oregon wanted to utilize, I guess, that the federal tax code in that way and just kind of piggyback off of that, then it could be set up to exclude those entities in their entirety. So if you are a specified service trade or business at the federal level, you are excluded from benefiting from Oregon's reduced rates. Again, at the federal level, there is a little more nuance there as well, where they have, if you're below a certain income level, but still in one of those sectors, you can still benefit potentially from the federal deduction, or you can have it phased out at one point as well. So there's kind of a couple different options in how Oregon might want to utilize that connection at the federal level. And then the other option that was in the amendment was the point specifically just to a sector and just include that, the entirety of that sector. So you could just exclude all of 54 and all of 62. And the idea is a taxpayer that has income from an entity from that sector, today they might be benefiting from these reduced rates. If those sectors were excluded, that taxpayer would no longer use that income from, say, a healthcare business. They would no longer use that income against the reduced rates.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Please do.
So Kyle, if we took your, please do not go back or keep this slide up. If we took your first presentation and the discussions we've been having in which do you regulate a sector, do you change a rate, do you change a cap, or do you change number of employees, I'm going to give you two examples and see if you can help us rationalize based on those three categories that we're talking about. If you take first line 54, that's professional science technology, and this is not derogatory, this is simply an example. Let's say you had a law firm and you're the lawyer in that sector there, but you only have one employee and that's your paralegal versus, say you were a lawyer and you were doing something else and you had six employees. By doing a manipulation, by requiring more employees, would that not ensure we had more employment? If we gave that benefit by using an employment number of saying, you know, you get this qualification if you have two or more employees along that line. How would the three policies you discussed in the beginning apply to a law firm, say, with one employee versus a law firm with 10 employees?
Yeah, Senator Boquist, so the current law right now just has that requirement of that one employee meeting those hours requirement. So if you have one or five, it doesn't really matter at this point under current law. With one of the proposals, so I suppose that's the Dash 2 proposal, was looking at a different way to apply whether or not that entity qualifies, I guess. So one of them could be looking at a ratio of employees to owners, or it could just be simply moving that instead of being one employee, the requirement could be three employees, four employees, five employees, something along those lines. So by doing that, certainly you could adjust the policy to focus on, I guess, entities with more employees in relation to the number of owners they have, or just more employees regardless of the number of employees you have. That would be a policy lever that you could adjust upwards from that one requirement that exists right now.
Thank you. Follow up, Madam Chair.
Please do.
The second thing is several years ago, Senator Riley and I got in hot water, and he's probably going to chuckle, when we were trying to review nonprofit status because of some of these healthcare issues out there. And in that sector 62, and one of the witnesses brought up an example here, you have a couple of categories of healthcare. I'll give two that are common out there now after affordable healthcare, and especially we see today during COVID. one example one is you have a dentist office which has a dentist, and then that dentist is the LLC, and I'm going to say her husband is the office manager, so there's two of them in the couple, and then they have eight employees. And of course, if you're a dentist, you don't get all the insurance stuff and you don't get all the Affordable Care stuff. So their income is one stream where there's two of them and they employ eight people. And the other model that we've seen and discovered is where you have six or eight doctors who are an LLC, and they're the only people in the LLC, and they contract their services back to the nonprofit. And so they have zero employees. Is there a mechanism by using the employee amendment in some manner in which we could help the dentist and the doctor who has six employees and providing rural health care, as example, versus not helping the doctors, which frankly have zero employees or just one to meet the minimum standard? Thank you.
Yeah, Senator Boquist, so one of the things that's in current law right now is that requirement for that one employee is that they're a non-owner. So I guess that's one thing that's in place right now today and would give another option, I suppose, and how you adjust something like that going forward, or how to count employees. That's something that's been coming up as well as are there other ways? Right now there's an hours requirement, 30 hours per week, to try to ensure that they're counting people that are, I think you could say, more than part-time, more than that 30 hours per week, so focusing that. But yeah, I think that employee, to your example there, would be trying to focus on the number of employees. In your example, that's where the ratio, perhaps, of the number of owners could be helpful. You could always look at a policy that maybe is trying to use a little bit of both, where you have a ratio in there as well, but at some point you say, well, if you have, you know, 15 owners or something like that, you could have that ratio not apply, where you could have a minimum and a ratio or something like that. There's different ways you could definitely try to tailor the policy to reach that desired policy outcome that you'd like.
Madam Chair, follow up slide 5, please. Thank you, Madam Chair. Kyle, I'd like you to re-explain this slide. Let me tell you where I'm going to. I'm very interested in talking about the left slide, line 51 to 100 employees and the average income on the right. And my observation here is these are sort of correlated. So the left side is the share of passive income by the number of employees. And then the right one is, in fact, I believe, the share of businesses by number of employees and what their average income. Is there a correlation between these two? And could you re-explain that before I point out several items?
Yeah, so Senator Boquist, these, I didn't include kind of the vertical axis here, but that goes all the way through. So this is kind of the first one here is one employee, and it's one employee over here as well. So you can follow that all the way across. But the orange bars are really talking or displaying the breakdown. So this would be the number of businesses or the amount of non-passive income where there's one employee for that business entity and the amount of that non-passive income that gets passed through. And of course, this could be, you could have one business entity that has one employee, but there could be two owners. So they could be passing it through to two different taxpayers. But that accounts for a bit over 10%. So a bit over 10% of all the non-passive income that's going against these reduced rates, you can think of it as sourced from a business entity that has one employee. In terms of the blue line, that's related to the count or the share of the count. And we could definitely provide the numbers behind these, but just to give you a sense of, in this case, where we saw the share of the income was about 10% was coming from business entities with one employee. In terms of an overall count of how many businesses there are, that would be about 20% of the overall count of what those businesses entities are that have the one employee. And then that's the average income in this case that's being passed through. So again, I think the average income could be adjusted just by the number of taxpayers you're passing through. And again, there's a lot going on in these slides. The information's pretty dense, and there's different ways to try to break that out to more align with what policy option you're looking at. But it was just trying to give you a general sense of, if you required, say, more than 11 or more employees, you can get a sense of, well, how much of the income then are we taking off or avoiding these reduced rates, or wouldn't be subject to these reduced rates? So you'd be at 10, close to 20 here, so 30, and then maybe 45% altogether is less than 10 employees. So it gives you some sense of scale of what that overall impact could be. But again, it depends upon where the marginal rates hit and everything like that. So there is some modeling that goes on there, but it gives you some sense of the scope or the overall share of where these things lie.
Kyle, do we have a way of breaking down, sorry to interrupt your line of questioning, Senator Boquist, but do we have a way of breaking down the ratio of employees to owners in some of the in that chart?
Madam Chair, that is, I think that's information we could get to based upon the underlying tax return data. It's not something our office has looked at in the past yet. So it's not a table or anything I have prepared for you today, but I think we could track that through based upon the reporting on the pass-through form going back to the entity. And I think we could true that up and try to follow that through as best we can. And that'd be, of course, working with our friends at the Department of Revenue to try to leverage the tax return data that we have and where we can make those matches, yes.
Okay, thank you. Senator Boquist, back to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So Kyle, I want to kind of run through an example here using that because it's the easiest one to use. That line on the left-hand chart there, that's 51 to 100 employees. And we heard testimony earlier, just, and this is just placemark testimony, that you know the median income is 67,000. I know the per capita income is 52,000 a year. And just for simple mathematics, I'm just going to say the employee makes $4,000 a month. And it's a manufacturing agricultural industry. And it is 100 employees on that line down there, 51 to 100. I believe I'm correct in saying that if I had 100 employees and they were paid $4,000 a month, to make my payroll on January 31st, I would need $400,000. Does that sound correct, Kyle?
I was trying to follow your math there, Senator Boquist. Did you say 100 employees?
100 employees at $4,000 a month. I think that means I need $400,000 before benefits and everything else to make that payroll on January 31st of a year.
Yeah, okay. Yes, I'm tracking with you, and I'm seeing Chris nodded as well, so that, yeah.
Okay, so the reason I've used this, Madam Chair, as an example is that to explain pass-through income so everybody's on the same sheet of music. In a pass-through entity, where do I get that $400,000? I have to get it out of my profit, correct? Because I have no ability to retain earnings as a C corporation. So I must make $400,000 in profit just to make the next month's payroll. Is that correct?
I think, Senator Boquist, in this case, you want receipts, definitely. Profit, necessarily, you could have $400,000 in receipts and then have that all go out to pay your employees, keeping it very simple with all the other costs. But it wouldn't necessarily, as employee costs or payroll would be part of your business cost, that would help determine whether or not you are making a profit.
I'm trying to use your economic degree here to help us. I'm talking about cash flow. In a pass-through at the end of December 31st, use my own old corporation, same way, S-Corp, pass-through, I pay taxes on $1 million as of December 31st, and I'm not being paid except every quarterly. I must finance out of that $1 million that I got my payroll for the next 90 days. This is not unlike a farm, a manufacturer, anybody else. What I'm trying to drive at is the pass-through, correct me if I'm wrong, the pass-through entity is not retaining earnings in the corporation. They must use their profit from that year to cash flow or have a line of credit to cash flow their expenses for the months going forward. Is that correct economically?
Yeah, Senator, I do think I'm following now where you're tracking here, because yes, with the pass-through entities, they don't always necessarily, the income itself from a taxation standpoint gets booked more or less as being passed through. There could be instances where that income does stay with the pass-through entity rather than actually going to the owners. But in that case, the owners would still be taxed as if they received that income. And then maybe in a later year, they're able to take a draw or something to that effect. But yeah, I think I'm following your example here where you're kind of using the same income to finance your next quarter, your next month, or how you're moving forward.
Thank you.
But you
would not, Madam Chair, what I'm trying to...
Go ahead.
Go ahead, ma'am.
But you wouldn't
what
be
I'm
paying
simply trying
taxes
to point out,
on that. I'm sorry. Let me just clarify. But you wouldn't, in a case like that, at the end of the day, you would not be paying taxes on that money at all if it all went to payroll. Is that correct?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I mean, if there's no income from the entity, there's nothing being passed through. So if the entity is making a loss because they are financing debt financing or something on those lines, yeah, you would be correct. There's nothing to tax at that point because there's no positive profit or no business income being passed through.
Madam Chair, Senator Bocas, what my point is that the agriculture entity, for example, is that, no, you don't pay taxes, but a C corporation pays its tax rate and retains its cash. It then uses that cash to operate month to month to month in the future. And of course, we've heard testimony, sometimes that's good, sometimes that's bad. The pass-through entity, if I make $1 million on my pass-through entity that year, I still must use that same $1 million to continue to operate that company in the future. It doesn't go in my pocket. That's called an owner distribution, and it's listed on the tax codes and the tax filings too. So I pay taxes on that. So when we look at a chart that says that line, average income is $1.2 million for that line, and you go to the other side and you have 100 employees, and you're, we'll just say, the onion grower or the onion manufacturer, and you don't sell your onions till 3 months later, you're paying your salaries and your employees through that. When I was a contractor, we generally got paid somewhere between 6 weeks and 120 days, 4 months from when we actually did the work. So we had to continually have 120 days of cash flow on hand just to operate. We in the legislature have decided that a business entity called DCBS or any of the other boards or bureaus needs 6 months of cash flow to continue to operate. And of course, they're using the treasury. Many of these businesses that are out there and we see these numbers, they're having to use that profit from this year on their taxes to cash flow the entity going forward. I'm simply pointing out that on line 51 to 100, if you had $400,000 worth of monthly salary, just to make the payroll the next month without seeing any receipts, you're going to burn up a good portion of the $1 million on the opposite side. That's what my point is, Madam Chair. So it's not just the size. You could have a large entity that looks like it's making money and it's not. The trick is to make sure it has employees. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm done.
Okay, thank you. Are there other questions or comments from the committee? Well, thank you. This has been a great discussion. Thank you for your charts and for your research on this, Kyle. I think this is a discussion that will be continued. We actually have two members of this committee that were on the original group that developed this tax system, myself and Senator Boquist, as he pointed out. And so I think as we navigate this, we'll have to go very carefully to make sure that the priorities that we had in mind when we adopted it are actually fulfilled by the system. Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd just like Kyle to clarify and make sure we all know we're really talking about two bills. This one, 139, and the other one I think is 137. I believe 139 is relating to taxation, so it has a broad relating clause. Is that not correct, Kyle? And 137 has the narrower clause?
Yeah, Senator Boquist, 139 is relating to taxation, yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I don't want you to get any big ideas from that, Senator Boquist.
Madam Chair, you already know I have a big idea, okay?
you're full of big ideas, Senator Boquist, and I appreciate that. Okay.
Well, Madam Chair, I just want to help out the most vulnerable people in Oregon is what I want to.
Well, and that's one value that we have. Another value that we have is growing jobs in Oregon to help our economy and supporting small business. And I think we need to keep those values in mind as we proceed with this discussion. So are there any further comments? Okay, Chris, I think we're done with our obligations today. Do you have anything else that we need to do?
No, that was your agenda for today.
Okay, thank you, everyone, committee, and our witnesses, and we are adjourned.